Good morning and welcome to the First Universalist Unitarian Society of New Haven. We are going to be taking a different perspective on what religion, liberal religion might be today. So it's very much in keeping with our past. So the opening words are from Julia Ward Howe, who was a Unitarian. And I just read a nice little thing about her on the web that said that she actually had a fairly emotional conversion experience. The conversion was from being just a Unitarian to being a Unitarian Universalist. And when she realized that all would be saved, this was a very emotional moment. So she also was someone who believed that God acts, and expressed this in her famous and popular hymn. I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps. They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps. You can read his righteous sentence in the dim and flickering lamps, while God is marching. Well, I'm going to do a rather extended reading from the Old Testament book of 1 Samuel. And I asked Shula and Steve to read the first two parts, and then I'll read the third part.
Now, Eli's sons were scoundrels and had no regard for the Lord. The custom of the priests in their dealings with the people was this. When a man offered a sacrifice, the priest servants would come while the flesh was stewing, and would thrust a three-pronged fork into the cauldron, or pan, or kettle, or pot. And the priest would take whatever the fork brought out. This should have been their practice. Whenever Israelites came to sacrifice at Shiloh, but now under Eli's sons, even before the fat was burned, the priest's servant came and said to the man who had sacrificed, "Give me the meat to roast for the priest. He will not accept what has already been stewed, only raw meat." And if the man answered, "Let them burn the fat first, and then take what you want," he said, "No, give it to me now, or I will take it by force." The young man's sins were very great in the Lord's sight, for they brought the Lord's sacrifice into general contempt.
Eli, now a very old man, had heard how his sons were treating all the Israelites, and how they lay with the women who were serving at the entrance to the tent of the presence. So he said to them, "Why do you do such things? I hear from all the people how wickedly you behave. Have done with it, my sons, for it is no good report that I hear spreading among the Lord's people. If a man sins against another man, God will intervene. But if a man sins against the Lord, who can intercede for him?" For all this, they did not listen to their father's rebuke.
And skipping ahead to the third chapter, I could say a little bit more background that the first couple of chapters of Samuel talk about the woman Hannah, who was childless and was very unhappy about that. So she went to this shrine in Shiloh and prayed for a son, and promised that she would then give the son back to the Lord to serve for life in that same shrine. So the boy Samuel is brought, and I don't know exactly how old he was. He probably was 8 or so. And he's been living there for quite a while. And he sleeps in sanctuary. So this was a tent that was the primary sanctuary in Israel at that time. This is before there was a king. And in this tent, in this particular chamber, you might say, was the Ark of the Covenant. So the Ark of the Covenant that had gone through the 40 years in the wilderness and was obviously about as sacred of an object as you could get was still extant. And there Samuel is sleeping next to it. So it's very important to realize that in the ancient world, everybody would have understood right away he was incubated. If you wanted to, for example, many people went to the temple of Asclepius, the god of healing, and they were incubating a dream. And many people had the experience that the god actually came and stood beside their bed and gave them some message or instructions. So it was possible to have this kind of extraordinary experience. So I think this is what the writer is assuming we're going to know, that if you're sleeping in a place like this, something might happen. So the text goes on. So the child Samuel was in the Lord's service under his master Eli. Now in those days the word of the Lord was seldom heard, and no vision was granted. But one night Eli, whose eyes were dim and his sight failing, was lying down in his usual place while Samuel slept in the temple of the Lord where the ark of God was. Before the lamp of God had gone out, the Lord called him, and Samuel answered, "Here I am," and ran to Eli, saying, "You called me, here I am." "No, I did not call you," said Eli. "Lie down again." So he went and lay down. The Lord called Samuel again, and he got up and went to Eli. "Here I am," he said. "Surely you called me." "I did not call, my son," he answered. "Lie down again." Now Samuel had not yet come to know the Lord, and the word of the Lord had not been disclosed to him. When the Lord called him for the third time, he again went to Eli and said, "Here I am, you did call me." Then Eli understood that it was the Lord calling a child. He told Samuel to go and lie down and said, "If he calls again, say, 'Speak, Lord, thy servant hears thee.'" So Samuel went and laid down in his place. Now, it used to be in Sunday school, that's where they stopped, you see. What the Lord actually said was very secondary. But, in fact, the text goes on, and it wasn't. What he said is actually somewhat hair-raising. The Lord came and stood and called Samuel, "Samuel," as before. Samuel answered, "Speak, thy servant hears thee." The Lord said, "Soon I shall do something in Israel which will ring in the ears of all who hear it. When that day comes, I will make good every word I have spoken against Eli and his family from beginning to end. You are to tell him that my judgment on his house shall stand forever, because he knew of his son's blasphemies against God and did not put a stop to them. Therefore, I have sworn to the family of Eli that their abuse of sacrifices and offerings shall never be expiated." Samuel lay down till morning, and then opened the doors of the house of the Lord, but he was afraid to tell Eli about the vision. Eli called Samuel. "Samuel, my son," he said, and he answered, "Here I am." Eli asked, "What did the Lord say to you? Do not hide it from me. God forgive you if you hide one word of all that he told you." Then Samuel told him everything and hid nothing. Eli said, "The Lord must do what is good in his eyes." As Samuel grew up, the Lord was with him, and none of his words went unfulfilled. From Dan to Beersheba, all Israel recognized that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. So the Lord continued to appear in Shiloh because he had revealed himself there to Samuel. So Samuel incubates a dream, and we can see in what was read the sort of pattern of prophecy enacted. We see God. Now I'm asking you to put God in quotation marks, meaning that which is pointed to by the word God, which may not be the same as graphic comics, the version of God. So God does something new, unheard of, outrageous, and wild. You understand that Eli represented the establishment. Probably not only the religious establishment, but the political establishment, since it's said later on that he judged Israel for 40 years. And this was the period of the so-called judges, which is before there was a king. A judge would be a charismatic leader who would arise under some circumstances and then would have a prestige to continue to exercise a lot of authority for his lifetime, but then he would die and there was nothing to continue it. So anyway, he represents, you could say, the establishment. So God, the imagination, creativity within the world of everyday life, within secular time. This is not an escape from the grim reality of our political, social, economic processes, into eternity. That is to say, into peace and rest. Rather, it is an escape from business as usual into the creative core of time. So God is an actor in time. This is not an unusual perspective, in terms of understanding of the Bible, especially the Old Testament. The typical understanding historically of the church has been, well, that was then, this is now, and there are still things where he acts, but it's more in the area of personal experience rather than overthrowing tyrants, for example. But anyway, God is depicted as the overthrower of settled systems, God the disturber, God the artist, God the creator, who is continuing to create here and now. So this is the idea that creation continues, didn't stop. God the maker of other arrangements. God the enemy of pious fraud, priestcraft, and clerical abuse. I hate, I despise your festivals, and I take no delight in your solemn assemblies. God reveals the new path hidden in among the trash and debris of an era. André Malraux, the novelist, became Minister of Culture in the government of Charles de Gaulle when he was older, and he took up a sort of new phase in his life of becoming an art historian. And he got to be quite a scholar, wrote several books. And one of the things he said that I always found interesting, he said, we live in a museum without walls. What he meant was that by the middle of the 20th century, with the media we have, with, of course, our imperial reach, so that we could get hold of things from all different cultures, and then with printing, and now, of course, we have internet. So in other words, potentially we have access probably to more cultural materials from the entire history and span of humanity than has ever existed in the past. So we live in a museum without walls in which all traditions, all cultures, all religions are open to us, even those of our own exotic past, as we find them in the Bible. Arthur Fry, the literary critic, said the Bible is the great code of the West. And he had a rather different take on it. So all these materials are available to us, offering us the possibility of taking what we can use and leaving the rest, which is the procedure of every artist or poet. As Unitarian Universalists, we are invited to improvise our own religion or worldview. Now, this might mean that we are open to a whole smorgasbord of religions and philosophies as individual consumers seeking to satisfy our, quote, religious needs. Whatever they are. Or it could mean that as a congregation, we could begin to move toward a new synthesis which would enable us to act together in a genuine and meaningful response to the critical issues of our time. So the pattern of prophecy in the Bible runs like this. The world of human practices and institutions has fallen into a state of corruption and wickedness. So Yahweh announces his intention to act to correct the situation through a chosen prophet. So first he tells him what he's going to do, you see. And then after the prophet announces it, then he does it. And when he does it, that means God actually enters into the mess of events to fulfill what he already told the prophet he was going to do. So he's in the middle of the mess, So we see this pattern with Noah when it was the whole world that had fallen into horrible ruin. We see it with Moses when the children of Israel had fallen into slavery in Egypt. We see it in this case with Samuel. And later on, Elijah, the writing prophets. We could go on to John the Baptizer and to Jesus. At no time in this series do we ever see God intervening in order to prop up the kingdoms of this world. Now, it's true that there's a whole other aspect about how he told the Israelites he was going to give them the land that belonged to someone else, but that's a sort of different problem. But that's sort of the nationalistic base of the whole tradition that is established. But within that, there's a continual manifestation of God as the enemy of the establishment, really. So inevitably, he is on the side of ordinary people against the powerful and the privileged. In the Magnificat sung by Mary after having the birth of Christ announced to her, she says, "He has put down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of low degree." And the whole thing has been called the Maccabean hymn. I mean, this probably existed before the New Testament was written, and somebody lifted it and put it in her mouth. So that's a way of telling us that this one be born, it will continue this role of being a liberator. And by the way, the word Jesus is Greek for Joshua, the word known to us in English as Joshua. So Joshua is the one that led into the Promised Land. Like I say, there's some problems with that Promised Land concept. But it's meant to say that he is somebody who saves you from oppression. So we live in an age when the crucifying powers remain active. Crucifixion was a method of state terrorism that the Romans developed, and it was a very potent tool of domination because what would happen is you would normally crucify someone who was viewed as a sort of enemy of the state type person, and you would then leave them up until they rotted completely. So that meant your total being has been obliterated. And it was, Ivan the Terrible did this sort of thing. He, during the period known as the gathering of the Russian lands, he'd go into a territory and he would kill most of the able-bodied men and pile their heads up in the square. And so you could smell them a mile away and there'd be a huge crowd of flies. And it was a very effective way to get people's attention. So Rome was doing this, and we know that this still remains a potent tool of domination because we have this famous photo from Abu Ghraib with the man with the thing over his head, and probably he's been wired up so that if he drops his arms, they give him a jolt. You know, they didn't kill him, but it still is reminiscent. And of course, obviously, crucifixion being a form of death by torture, actually. So the only possible response to this situation, where the crucifying powers are still active, for those of us who seek to live our lives out of a constant connection to the original and genuine sources of life, is to organize ourselves into a community of resistance. Or perhaps we might say better, to invent new ways to express that resistance which already lives in our hearts. This cannot mean to form a new counter-empire. Rather, it means to discover afresh the creative depths of time and place, to enter into new orders of emergent life. Not to try to go back to the imaginary, stable order of an idealized past, as fundamentalists do, but instead to find the mysterious, unknown path revealed by the imagination, which is imminent in the very fabric of our embodied, temporal, and historically conditioned lives. This is what it means to say God acts in history. It means the process of creation of the world and the process of creativity within the historical stream is the same process. So that means we're not alone in our resistance. There's something in the very nature of things that resists tyranny, according to this. So, as we dwell in a museum without walls, we might note that this creative element, which in the West has been imagined as a great God who moves through history, has been envisioned in Taoism as the mysterious female. Well, I realize that their ideas about history are different, but nevertheless, we see the same idea of the profound immanence of the creative element. And so my thought in terms of the museum without walls and in drawing on all these sources is that we need both of these images. We need the image of the God who acts in history, as we also need the image of the mysterious female. In order to adequately respond to the turmoil of our time. And the question is, can we hold them together? Can we see the world with binocular vision? Two or more traditions or faiths are required if we are to see clearly. The Knights of the Round Table, having decided to go on the quest, agreed among themselves that each one would enter the enchanted forest at that point which appeared to him to be utterly lacking in a sign or a path. That is to say, they opened themselves to a mysterious leading from something completely outside the vision of the conscious, socially conditioned ego. They entered wilderness. You ever notice how in the Bible, the wilderness is a place where people meet God? So if you want to meet God, that's where you have to go. Because his ways are strange. He is wild. You must detach yourself from the received, settled, routinized ways of society where getting and spending is the whole of the law. If you can't do that, then you'll never have this experience. So often when folks attempt to organize resistance, they do so in ways that are so old hat, so obvious, and well known to the dominating mind of the powers that be, that they can counteract them in their sleep. But when the deep layers of imagination, the mysterious female, the wild god, appears within the flux of time and events, this is not the case. Everyone is taken by surprise. We read from the New English Bible, and God says, I'm going to do a thing that will ring in the ears of everyone that hears it. The Revised Standard has, it will cause the ears of everyone that hears it to tingle. Now, to me, that has a slightly more uncanny quality to it. It's like not ringing, but after you've heard it, your ears are physically tingling, you know. So there's something uncanny involved when this real deep creative response to the circumstances of time arises. So the power does not want us to organize, does not want us to imagine the world from our own point of view. That is, from the place where we find ourselves embedded within the dynamic and ever-changing stream of time. Globalization has declared all cultures to be forms of property, commodities even. There must be no restraint of trade in commodities, in any commodity, just as Mexican corn must compete head-to-head with the federally subsidized corn produced by U.S. agribusiness, so the ancient stories of the world's cultures must compete with Hollywood blockbusters. The culture of empire forcibly breaks up the imagination of all cultures, robbing them of their ability to resist. Their cultural immune system becomes infected by the virus of extreme commercialism. Let's face it, we're all in it for the money. If you deny it, you're not being honest with yourself. This is the word on Wall Street. This is the word on Madison Avenue. This is the word in the halls of Congress. If you imagine any standard by which you might judge a society other than that of money, then you are deluded. Resistance is futile. If you try to resist anyway, we will crucify you, and your torture will be a public display of your shame, futility, and insanity. People will mock you and deride you. You will become a pariah and a laughingstock. But here's the big news. Like Eli and the priestly establishment of his day, the powers that be, the crucifying powers of an unrestrained and all-devouring commercialism, have lost the connection with the sources of life. They are extremely agile, brilliant in winning the game. They are forcing us all to play, but they are literally unable to imagine any other game. And this includes alternatives that might emerge out of the ground of our own Western and or biblical traditions as much as others. Tina, there is no alternative, is the straitjacket that constrains their minds to the end of time. Those of us who choose to resist may well feel like strangers in a strange land. This is why we need to find each other and support each other. This is why we must meditate day and night on the sources of life. The theology of postponement has been normalized. What if the churches are no better as an expression of the core vision of Jesus and the early community than the United States is at present an authentic expression of democracy? At the present time, democracy is a code word for complete and total takeover of society by business values. All other values have gone into the wastebasket reserved for unthinkable thoughts. Democracy equals deregulation. Democracy means no restraints on the powerful few who own everything, who run everything, and control everybody. Is it not the case that at present democracy equals imperial domination? Democracy is but a euphemistic cover for empire. And Christianity is the spiritual support of the same insofar as it operates as but a part of the general propaganda system. But how is this possible? Jesus was crucified by the empire, but nowadays he bows down to the empire and enjoys worldly power as an agent of empire? Something stinks here, real bad. In fact, the pagan movements of our time are resisting empire because the church has failed to do so. Whereas the fate of the earth was central in Jesus' visionary initiative, the church has forgotten this earth, this body of joy. Of course, you know, they're remembering a little bit, and it was nice that after the ecology movement got really big, they decided, well, maybe we should think about this, you know. Well, anyway, so if this is true, insofar as this is true, that the church has forgotten the earth and this body of joy, then the betrayal by Judas pales in comparison. So Christianity, as we have known it, is too idealistic for this world. It needs paganism to balance it out and give it feet and mud. In the early days, paganism was the established religion, the normal default position. Thus, a healthy admixture of paganism was almost automatically present as the background of the early movement. These people tell us that there were whole families buried in the catacombs. Some were Christian, some were pagan. So, that, I mean, very interesting. But can the same be said of paganism? Does paganism somehow need Christianity? This is really the more important message I'm trying to bring here. That, to me, the idea of the God who acts means a kind of people coming together in a community and becoming a force. In the time of empire, a cosmopolitan time when looting, raping, and killing the earth and its peoples is normal behavior, a time when all systems of government and business and the dissemination of information are dedicated to making money flow uphill through the penthouses of New York and the hilltop mansions of L.A., in such a time, Christian paganism arises as a grassroots movement powered by a passion for justice and a longing for the lost earthly paradise. After the terrors of history and the vast damages which are the legacy of empire, the human heart still cannot wholly forget its earliest love. The Song of Songs stands as the central text of the Abrahamic religions, testifying to the wonder of the earthly paradise. It can never be revoked. The soul of sweet delight can never be defiled. So we could have the first closing words. This is a young man of Indian background who is a brilliant jazz pianist. And on his album, from which you're going to hear a cut, he has this little sort of like a poem. Rebuild the world around you, imagining an end to the suffering you see. Resist that which is forced upon you. Listen instead to the sound of your own imagining. Mm-hmm.